welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my very special guest, Daniel Bright, nearly former ex-YWAMer. Daniel, that introduction makes me laugh. I actually just had a conversation earlier today with a former YWAMer, the real kind, not the nearly former YWAMer, and we were talking about some of the struggles that they had, and hopefully we'll be getting into that a lot more. But anyway, you have been nearly an ex-YWAMer, as we talked about last time, and you've been digging deeply into the manifested sons of God, the mystery church, all of this weird spiritual mess that they have today that they claim as a divinely inspired, I don't know, movement by God. And you're digging under the hood to some of the same things that I found when I began my research. So it's going to be fun to talk through it. I'll admit that it's been, gosh, that was 2014. I started looking at some of the names you've mentioned. Jacob Bohm. I've actually since learned it's pronounced Bohme. Bohme,
yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah.
Different names, but I came across these names when I barely even knew how to research. Steve Montgomery and I talk about them quite a bit. Steve is pretty deep into it. So anyway, it'll be fun to hear your fresh new perspective, and we can talk about that. But first, remind people who you are and your connection to all of this research.
Yeah, I live in Norway. I've been living here since 2016, and I work as a gardener for the local municipality. I go to a free Lutheran church in Norway, in Hamar Free Church. And it's a town about 150 miles north of Oslo. It's not very big. It's 40,000 of us. There's four big churches and three bad churches, as they say. The churches we do go to, the churches we don't go to. The church is heavily affected by YWAM. And so it's about, I would say, 70% ex-YWAM. 70% of people there have been at YWAM. Not to say they're ex. They used to be in it. And they're still Christians. So the Norway's biggest YWAM base is within walking distance, if you can walk an hour and a half from our church. And the number two of the national YWAM team, she is a woman leader. She is at our church, and there's a lot of people in on staff. And as I mentioned to you just before, there was someone in my church who recognized me from our previous time I was on. She said, "Hey, Daniel, I was watching you on YouTube. And yeah, I was talking about this church and a lot of the stuff that has been going on." So for 10 years, I've been, I don't want to use a negative word, like surrounded, embraced by many YWAMers. And I've seen to reiterate what I said the last time, my objections are the economical, financial impact of YWAM and volunteerism. Just recently, we had someone preaching who was in YWAM for many years, and he was saying that he would get the bills for each month and, rent and car and insurance. He would lay his hand over it and pray that these would be paid. That's a level of trust that I think is unbiblical and unchristian, because Paul does say to us each week, you do a bit of budgeting. What do you need to spend on food? What do you need to spend on all of this? On your insurances, perhaps? And whatever you've got left, you give to the poor. Jesus say, don't worry about tomorrow, whatever it brings. But in a certain sense, your weekly and monthly budgeting, that's on you, really. As a Christian, I, as a YWAMer or not a YWAMer, would pray for the coming year. I don't know what's going to happen in the next 12 months, but really the next 4 weeks are a result of my own financial planning. So you shouldn't be praying over the bills you need to pay before you click send on your internet banking, whatever. That's down to you, and God has given you that sovereignty to really just work and get a job. So that's my relationship with YWAM. There's no large-scale scandals from the local base. It's just the far more pedestrian, sad stories of people who've given a lot to this organization and they haven't got much to show for it by the time they're 35 and want the house and mortgage. That's my, I would say, biggest worry about anyone getting into YWAM. That he's not going to be financially viable by the time you're 40. It's youth with a mission, and when you're in your mid-30s like me, it's not you. It's time to get out. And I originally came across you following the Mike Pickle stuff, but then I realised it was onto YWAM. And I remember emailing you years ago saying, oh, you're going to get onto YWAM one day, and you have. But what I was listening to you talk to Jed Hartley about some of the parent scandals, and I'd still agree with you that I'm not so interested in researching it. That's kind of the John Collins 3.0. You know, maybe in 30 years' time, someone like you is going to be researching all this. They'll probably know a lot more in 3 decades because a lot more things will come to light. People will be publishing books. So we can't give IHOP KC the same level of research in that sense. So that's why I'm really interested in Jane Lead, with an E or sometimes without an E, depending on some searches. And she was mystic. She was a poorly thought through Christian, let's call it that. A mystic sounds a bit too complimentary, really.
Yeah.
She's the person who I wouldn't invite to my conference if I was running one, put it that way. And Norwich back then doesn't sound like a very big place, but it was the sort of second city of England at the time, the late 1690s. So this is about the same time as the Salem witch trials. That was the age of the buckled hats, old-fashioned statement going on there. So she didn't write stuff herself, but a lot of her followers wrote after it, wrote a lot of what she said. And as I sort of said to you before, when we map some of the modern terms onto her, they can make a lot more sense, like her bridal theology, talking about preparing the bride and stuff. I'm trying to condense all the stuff that I've learned from you, really, from 2 or 3 years ago. You did Jane Lead with someone who is much more well-read on it and more researched on converging apostasy. When I was researching Jay Leiden as well, it was very difficult to avoid actually just coming back to you anyway, because not many other people were looking into this. So for those uninitiated, Jane Lead, that was her, as I said, a mystic. She was in the late 17th century. What I'm most interested in is taking out 3 points of her ideas, which I think are most important for us today in understanding the modern Pentecostal charismatic situation we're in, which is that a lot of it comes from her. There was, you'll have to hop in and correct the terms I'm using here, but she talked a lot about the visible and the invisible church. And would you like to start with a lot of researching which Star Trek references were going to work best? It's section 31, which is a secret group within everyone else who's then going to manifest and explode and be the real deal. And the weakness with that is when you have the secret group, which is us, it quickly becomes not them. And I was thinking, when you can call that group whatever you want. I think they call them the forerunners in IHOP KC. And other people, they would call them associates or people who've maybe gone to Bible college for 3 years, or someone who's got the right surname. So in every church, you've always got a group within it. That's different from saying you've got the priesthood or people that are ordained, because in a church you might vote for elders and you might appoint a pastor. That's a little bit different. But Jane Lead kind of was embryonic for the idea of within the church you've got the core, the nuts, or it might be on the outside. It might even include people who aren't Christians. And from them will arise the real deal. They're the ones who are going to kick it into gear. And, the group within the group is gonna bring forth all of this stuff that's gonna happen. And I just see that in a lot of Pentecostal charismatic churches, and even Reformed, to a lesser extent, you've got the group within the group. And how does that turn out? And if we're saying, well, that's bad, well, what's the alternative? What is good theology in terms of what is the church, what's the group? And I take the Catholic, Roman Catholic or Lutheran position. You don't have a group within the church that's going to emerge and say, oh, these guys had it all along and we didn't realise. It's more the case that the true church is one with scandals galore, but there's not an invisible church that's going to emerge from it. The church as we see it is what it is, Lutheran, Anglican, Methodist and, you know, Reformed, the one true Catholic and Apostolic Church. That's what I believe. There's no secret group coming up through it.
I remember when I came across that, I was just completely dumbfounded that this problem had existed that long. Because what is being described is basically a cult. We have this group. We're a special group. We're not like the others of our Christian faith. We're this special elitist group. And I started going through, I went through all kinds of different pathways of research that led me into Gnosticism and spiritualism and whatnot. But what I found was this. After I left the Branham religion, I got really deep into conspiracy theories, which a lot of people who leave cults do, because they recognize that within a conspiracy theory, you have a group that literally has the secret knowledge, the special knowledge, and they're keeping it from everybody else. Why are they doing this? There must be something wrong, evil with this group. And then I got into history, and I realized that that's not unique to the Christian faith. It's not even unique to faith in general. We had, during the spiritualist craze in the United States, you had all of the spiritualists who had all of their secrets. You had the Masons had all of their secrets. And I thought Masonry was this purely evil form that only the evil people joined. And I found some really good people who were Masons. So then you've got this complex web of, well, now there's levels of knowledge within the groups. And then that led me to, well, what about all of the other fraternal orders? They're all structured the same way. And what I came to realize was I just kind of moved all of that out to the side. And I don't know if you've seen the show Little Rascals, or there's some movies, Little Rascals, and black and white TV shows. And I've mentioned this before. There's one episode where I think it's Spanky has a marble, and he's keep it. It's a secret marble. He's special because he's got the big one, right? And everybody's got the little tiny ones. And that's really what it's like. It's like a bunch of kids, and they think they've got the better marble than the rest of them. They're really the same. They don't really have anything special. But if they can brag that they have something special that the others don't have, the others want to get in, right? I started, once I made that connection, I started thinking back to all of the things that we had as our divine mysteries in the group we came out of, and none of them were really that special. In fact, a few of them were actually in the Bible. You could just read the Bible and get these secret mysteries. We didn't really have anything special, but we pretended that we did. And the things that we did have special, if people knew what they were, they really wouldn't want them. So when I came across what you're describing, all of these secret entity, and the Jane Lead and her historical lineage is only one pathway of this. You can find it all the way back to the mystery cults of the ancient world. You have a group of people who are doing the same thing. We have something special. If you come in our group, you get the special thing. We're not like the rest. We're a little bit better. And in the end, it's a different marble.
I think it contrasts with the true Christian idea of what the church is, which is, instead of going to someone saying, I've got the true special marble, which is unique, you come along and say to them, look, all of the marbles you've got, they're all cracked, they're all broken. And actually, there's one true marble, which none of us have, but Jesus does. And that's why he's talking about the pearl of great price, not the Mormon reference. He's talking about the pearl of great price, the man who sold everything in his field to buy. Which is to say, it's not an ideal that we try and achieve. It's a standard that we can never reach. And it's only Jesus who has that one true marble in that situation. My position on it being a mystery, then it needs to be revealed. That's why Paul says in somewhere, or one from, let's say, Peter, Paul, even he got confused himself. He said, did I say it or did Peter say it? He was saying that this is the mystery of the gospel, which is Christ revealed. So when people are telling you you need new information or new light, which is quite that's a grandparent of a Jehovah's Witness terminology that they use. We've got new light and provision from our organization, which is going to tell you the truth. It's the idea that that Gnosticism in Greek means to know. And if you ever wondered why do we spell it with a K, it's because it did come from Greek first. Gnosticism, like in Greek, we drop the G, so we drop the K in English. So Gnosticism just means knowledge, and it means you've got to know something extra. And for anyone who's played Dungeons and Dragons or is a little bit familiar with Warcraft or anything like that, when you're a priest or a paladin, there's a difference between intelligence and wisdom. Intelligence is usually someone who knows a lot of things, and wisdom is like the guy who says, yeah, but you don't put tomato in a fruit salad, you know. It's one thing to know stuff. It's another thing to have wisdom. That's why Solomon asks for wisdom. And I think there are a few people called the wisdom cult. Didn't they end up with something to do with an angel called Emma is really bizarre. But the wisdom cults, at least they're a bit closer to the terminology the Bible uses. The Bible wants us to obtain wisdom. You can be a very wise person and not really know anything. But it's very common to know a lot of things, but not really know what to do with that information and become rather unwise. But you're right with the conspiracy theories that a lot of that was prevalent at the time. This guy I mentioned earlier, Henry Dodwell, he reviewed Dane Leed at the time, and well, he reviewed some of the stuff she was going on about. And he was a bit of an odd chap to pin down. He was born in Ireland. He was a free church who didn't take the oath of allegiance to William and Mary when they took the throne, which is a bit strange. He said that Dane Leed was writing and using a lot of terms in Latin, whereas the style of English he was using was still a lot of these and thous, which to us makes us think that Dane Leed was writing or it was being written about in a very formal type of English. Everyone used thee and thou back then, but she was peppering her writing with incorrect Latin, and she was throwing terms around which didn't really know what they were saying, like that meme that's out there. I'm not sure that word means what you think it means. And that really made me think of the modern NAR when you've got, you know, the New Apostolic Reformation. They're throwing out a lot of terms where they may be speaking in tongues and not knowing what they're saying. It's when you're peppering your language with words that sound really impressive, that are doing a lot of work for you, but either don't mean what you wanted to, or you're just trying to hide behind using very high contested terms. So she wouldn't use the term manifested sons of God. When you're talking about manifesting something, it just means showing it. And I mentioned in the previous time we spoke that sometimes I was trying to translate a lot of the Branhamism terms to people. When I tried translating manifested sons of God, It came up with that word kind of translates into Norwegian as elected representative of God. You know, I think the last thing God would want is an elected representative talking about waste disposal management and the speed limits within zoning laws. If you use a term like manifested sons of God, that's very Dane Leed thinking, which is to use an advanced term hidden behind Latin. But if you just said to people, manifested sons of God just means we're the ones who are going to be doing it, Then the kind of Latin, it all comes crashing down and you're just left with very urgent street English, and people say, oh, that doesn't make any sense at all. You mean we're the ones who are going to be implementing it? Yeah. And that implies that God is either too weak or that I couldn't pin down exactly where she was talking about that in those terms. That idea of outsourcing the job to us just implies that God can't be bothered doing it. And that group of the invisible church that I mentioned earlier, that gets a bit worse, because then the manifested sons of God have to bring about the kingdom by certain acts of sabotage to bring about the end times, however much they think needs to be accelerated. I can't remember what term she uses for the manifested sons of God. And likewise, I struggled to find where she comes up with the term the bride, preparing the bride for the church. Because today there's a guy out there a couple of years ago who pretended he'd come up with the translation of the new translation of the Bible. He couldn't read Aramaic or Greek, but he said he was going back to the original Aramaic, which he can't speak. And it was something called the Passion Translation. And he said that the final word that Jesus uttered on the cross was bride. Where he got that from. Jesus says, it is finished. But he said, oh, but the word in Aramaic was bride. Don't know where he got that from. But the idea of bridal theology is biblical. It's from Revelation 21, where the new bride of Christ coming down from heaven from God, the new Jerusalem. That theme isn't really picked up on very much. In fact, just a couple of weeks, someone I was listening to you interviewed actually talked about that. But he was interviewed for a position as a pastor, and he said, my job is to prepare the bride for the groom or something like that, prepare Christ's bride for the coming of Christ. And so when he said that, that's going right back to 1690 to Dane Leed. He doesn't know that it came from her. I just don't think that sort of phrase would have originated from your average Methodist Lutheran church down the road or Second Presbyterian. or just off Main Street. These kind of ideas aren't really going to come from people just reading Revelation 21. They're going to come from someone who went to ILBKC, who learned stuff from Bob Jones, William Branham from Parham, da, 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 da. You know, stuff that you probably think about in your sleep all the time. You know the family tree. That's where it's come from. And it all went back to Jane Lead, this idea of us being the bride. And it's just so strange that a concept which is present in the Bible can be misconstrued first by Jane Lead and then people later on. I just don't know what it is with about the bride. I think it might just be overly sexualizing the images, which is, again, sort of hashtag IHOPKC, which just means that you're keeping people pure for Christ. But as soon as you talk about wanting to keep someone pure for the groom, that issue of purity then becomes something that you're scared of losing, which is very important. And as I said before, to reiterate, I can't match up to the level of research. All I can think about is the concepts which you guys have brought up many years ago just really got me thinking that Jane Lee came up with that idea of bride. When you push that onto the church, you're saying that we need to stay pure, we need to be kept pure, whereas the Christian life for me is all about confessing each week that we've all sinned and all fallen short of the glory of God. So maybe that's the kind of bride that we need to come to. If you want to talk about the bride of Christ, but to focus on how Israel related to God in what he describes as his honeymoon period in the Sinai desert, they created other gods. They were moaning. They say, "We don't want this. We want a divorce. We want to go back to Egypt." That's the bride of Christ.
Yeah.
That's what it's like being married to God. You want an instant divorce. And he's like, "Why don't you just kill you all and just have a new marriage with Moses?" It was a shocker of a honeymoon. And that's what God called later on in the Old Testament, his honeymoon period with Israel. Use that as a picture for the bride of Christ, an imperfect people who complain a lot, who certainly aren't worthy of it, rather than keeping the bride pure by a series of rules which tends to hinge around donating a lot of money so that Kenneth Copeland can get a new private jet. I'm not really sure how that prepares the bride for Christ. But yeah, that concept of purity is ultimately not Christian. Only Christ is pure. We can't be made pure and we can't remain pure.
Well, it all fits together. And this is my opinion. I'm not a Bible scholar or I'm not an expert in Jane Lee by no means. But what the mystery cults did was they took something that was a little bit obscure that people couldn't understand and then said, we know what it is. We have the knowledge. We have the gnosis. And they would take passages. So Jane Lee, this manifested sons of God thing, the only thing that I have found her say, and I can't remember which one of her documents, and it was probably ghostwritten, but she references, what is it, Romans 8, I think it is, Paul says, the all of creation is groaning, waiting for the manifestation of the sons of God. It's actually a Bible phrase. It's not something unusual. And if you read it in the context of what Paul is saying, he's basically saying, look at this world. This is a mess. We're waiting for something else. There's not anything that's mysterious or special. He's just talking about the state of affairs as they are. However, because it's a little bit obscure, people want to read more into it than is actually said. So when you read through Jane Lead's documentation, she's trying to pack into it the idea that we're different than the other Christian. We're building a pure church. It's taking the church and it's flipping it upside down. Instead of the pastors teaching the people to become leaders themselves, leading by teaching people to lead, instead, the pastors, the shepherds, the elders, all of the church members have something that's special that you don't have. And you can't get it as a member unless first you have to join us. And then it's like the carrot on the stick. Join us, but then we're still not going to tell you what it is. We have it. You don't. It's essentially the same exact framework that NAR has. You join NAR. You believe you have the special thing, whatever version of the charismatic weirdness that you have. It's a special thing, so you join this one group or this other movement. Well, once you get in there, the leadership has something that still you don't have and you'll never have because they're always one level higher. Well, that's what she is pushing, is the idea that you have to become pure. We're the ones who are preparing you to be pure. And everybody in the audience is thinking, wait a minute, how do you do that? How do I get rid of my daily thoughts, because I'm human. I'm going to have human thoughts, human emotions. And, you know, just from a psychological standpoint, not many people take a step back to just think about how that would even work. Because as a human, I have human emotions. I get angry. I can't help it. I get angry. I get sad. I get mad. I get all of the flood of emotions, right? What if I'm in a room, I'm interacting with a person, and their emotion that they're feeling has a conflict with mine, and then the argument gets heated? Well, both of us have the potential to wander off into sinful language against each other, right? And neither one of us really meant to. We just had this psychological thing that happened. We had a conflict. Well, in the eyes of this movement, you have something that can keep you pure, keep your thoughts pure, keep you holy. Nobody on this earth can do this, because you're going to get into situations that are outside of your control. So you come to the movement, you think, oh my gosh, they can do this for me. And you never stop to think that nobody can do this. There's no way possible for them to do this. And it's a carrot on the stick. They will never achieve what the leader has.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
There's a British series, a book series that's 200 years old called Hornblower. Winston Churchill was a big fan of it. It was dramatized in the 1990s. And in one of the episodes in that book, there's an entire crew who gets transferred onto a different ship by a captain who'd fought at Trafalgar. And, you know, he was really old and doddery, and he didn't have it together anymore. And he was being heavily medicated. But his entire crew, who hadn't been at the Battle of Trafalgar, but were younger than him, said, oh, he's the best, he's the greatest guy. And they were really sucking up to him and brown-nosing him and just having a go at the new guy, saying, well, you know, he's our captain, he's been at Trafalgar. These guys hadn't been. So what happens with these purity and bridal cults and need in these societies is that when everyone realizes they're falling short and they can't reach, you know, they can't achieve what leaders manage or the in-group, what they do is they start attack these acolytes, you could call them that, the supporters. They'll start attacking people who don't support them, just like in any football club or any sports club. People who aren't even on the pitch support the team and talk about us. And he's like, you're not even playing. You're not even on the pitch. You know, you're just watching. And so that purity group becomes worship of the people who know they can't be that. It's kind of like men worshipping elves, I suppose, in that sense. And it's not. And when you realize you can't achieve that, it's what Jesus talked about with the Pharisees. He said to his disciples, tongue in cheek, that your righteousness must exceed that of the Pharisees, because the Pharisees just meant the people who were separated. They were trying to be even holier, and people were like, I can't even be as holy as a Pharisee. So it ended up them slagging off other people, saying, well, you can't be as holy as the Pharisees. So the in-group doesn't necessarily even become an in-group. It's got an external group outside that of people saying, look at them, they're the manifested sons of God. They've got it going on. And when you said that about that verse in Romans, there's another one from Psalms where God says, you are all sons of God's. You're going to be gods one day. You're going to be sons of God's. I can't quite remember the term, but there's tension. There is a tension throughout the Bible in terms of these titles. We may know that a lot of Christians would ask, is Jesus the Son of God? We have to be aware that that's actually a political title. Caesar called himself the Son of God, the various pharaohs did as well. But no one called themselves the Son of Man. So it's quite interesting that whenever new cults start, they always want to give their followers a title which sounds more holy. They're going to say, a manifested son of God. I'd be fascinated to hear of a cult that calls themselves the manifested sons of men, because they may be using a spiritual term about themselves, but Jesus actually uses a human term to describe his divinity, which is quite paradoxical when you think about it. The Bible does say that we will become gods with a small g, depending on your understanding of lowercase English grammar. But that means we're not going to become Yahweh, but I suppose we're going to become what God intended us to be at creation, which is co-participated in his heavenly plan. And that's not going to happen in 2026 in Kansas or in London or in Norway. We're not going to be the manifested sons of God now. And better than sons of gods, we will be gods. And that's a belief I have, because I don't understand it. I don't understand what Psalms is talking about when it says you will all become gods. I guess we'll all become some sort of supernatural being, whatever happens in the new heaven, the new earth. But whatever that plan is, it's not going to be brought about by someone saying, give me all of your money in your 20s so that I can own 3 houses and a plane. That's not how you manifest the sons of God. Financial scams, that's not going to bring it about. So no matter how hard you try for in terms of bridal theology. And also I mentioned in some of the notes I sent to you, there was something that happened in Sweden about 20-25 years ago, over a long period of time, which was someone in a Pentecostal church where she had been a youth leader in her mid-20s, and she ended up marrying one of the young men in a youth group. Warning signs already. She described herself as the Bride of Christ, and in a rather sort of auto-filled scandal, she ended up sleeping with a lot of people and got people to kill other people in this tiny church. That's sweet. And it was tiny. It was like 50 people there. So just outside Stockholm in Sweden. And again, this idea of the bridal stuff, it narrows itself down quite quickly from we're the bride of Christ to I'm the bride of Christ, and I'm the bride of Christ, therefore give me your money and or women or young men. And that's what it tends to look like. There's a non-Christian called Tom Hollands, not the Spider-Man actor, who wrote a really good book called Dominion a couple of years ago. And he said, he's still not a Christian, but I think he's going to become one soon. He said that the idea of Christianity did away with the idea of purity, in a sense, because as soon as you are pure and sinless, woe be to anyone who loses that salvation.
You know, whenever I first began studying all of this, we had such loaded language around that phrase. You had the manifested sons of God, of course, because that was the phrase from Romans 8. But you also had the son of man language, the son of God language. And we had it in such a way that we didn't understand it, and we thought it was more than it was, which is exactly how a mystery cult works. I'll never forget the shock whenever I was watching Narnia, and they use the phrase son of Adam quite frequently. And I started scratching my head, wait a minute, son of Adam. And I went and looked it up, and sure enough, in, I don't know if it's all of the Bible passages, but in many where it's talking about son of man, it simply means human. It doesn't mean anything special. Yeah. So it means literally son of Adam. You are a descendant from Adam. And I started thinking about that. Good Lord, we had so many different things. Like Branham would go on to this rant about how Jesus never came in the name Son of Man, Son of God. He came in the name Son of Adam, because you will be the sons of God. And he tried to make it something that it wasn't. Like Jesus was lesser, we will become greater. That's literally how he taught it. And it was just so wrong and so heretical. Whenever I heard, Aslan, the lion, when he says, the sons of Adam, I started researching it, and I started reading the passages differently, because when you read it in that phrase, if you just replace it with the word human, now it reads so simply, like you as a human, you have access to this. You as a human, you will sin, you will fall. You as a human, you will do these other things. But it gives more power to the statement, sons of God. Because what it is saying essentially is you were a human, you descended from Adam, but creation is groaning, waiting for you to become a son of God. In other words, instead of this lineage where you're a human, you're going to become a little bit more than a human. And it doesn't mean anything special. It just means literally God is adopting you as a son or a daughter of God. When I understood that, I was like, why in the heck did they complicate this so much? Why did they turn into this big secret mystery? And as you said earlier, Jesus was the mystery fulfilled. There shouldn't be any other mysteries.
Yeah. For anyone interested in a much more powerful realization about the Son of Man, Son of God thing, I would recommend they look up a guy called Nabil Qureshi, who for a very short period of time, he's sadly died of cancer. He was a Muslim evangelist who had a conversion experience. He got converted to Christianity. For a very short period of time, he was a fantastic apologist. And he talked about this Son of Man, Son of God thing and really explained it to me. So I thought, why does Jesus always prefer the term Son of Man, the Son of Man? Because you're right, it does just mean a human, a Son of Man. And gradually through it happens during the Apocrypha, the Book of Enoch, where the Son of Man is a figure of divine, I guess, appearance, who slowly comes through Proverbs as the idealized manifested human. So it's interesting that God turns on his head. He said, rather than us trying to achieve divinity, is God managing to achieve humanity in a way that we couldn't do it? The old saying, you know, if you want to become like God, become a man, because that's what Jesus managed. Branham completely missed the point there by saying, Jesus was only the Son of Man, we're the sons of God. Everyone was the son of God. Pharaoh was, Caesar was, Putin would have been. So, and when everyone puts upon themselves a divine title, they lose it very quickly. But there's very few people that would say, I am the regular guy. Who would call themselves that? I know it might be a phrase sometimes in the US you talk about, he's a true son of the South. But if you said, this person is the son of the South, well, hang on a second now. You're saying that there is one standard son of the South. This is who it is. I have no idea what that would be. But from a Christian context, the Son of Man embodies everything it is to be, everything it should be to be human, which is obedient to God, simply. And that's what Jesus achieved. Why he doesn't like the term the Son of God. When they accuse him and say, are you the Son of God? He says, it is as you say, because it was a political title. And that idea of it being a political title, Jesus knew it. That is very telling, because I know you've been talking more and more recently about how you think this whole thing, the NIR, it wasn't even a religious thing. It was some sort of political thing with the CIA involved and all of that. And I don't think that's a conspiracy. When you're talking about the oil stuff in Uganda, I can believe that oil exists. And it was very common, particularly in North and South America, for the Jesuit missionaries to be quite present on the slave plantations. And for people who are misusing God's message to achieve political and oily ideas, really. And so for the man of the Son of God being a political title fits very well with the modern manifested sons of God pushing a political agenda, being much more concerned about all of that. I can't remember if it was mentioned recently, something to do with there's some bill going through in some places in the States about some law that is about statute of limitations. I haven't quite followed it, but the people who are against that are often some of them are religious groups and some of them are business groups. But there's some sort of shady links there that I think this modern charismatic Pentecostal movement has really allied itself with extreme forms of political stuff. I'm tiptoeing around talking about any political people in particular, but we do know that certain flags were waved to certain events in January a few years ago, and those flags were from the NAR. They are people wanting to manifest their sons of God in a way that means that we should support their business interests in the Middle East, which is a very specific way of understanding Revelation 21, Romans 8. But it seemed to go back to money. Can't quite remember if Jane Lead goes for that angle of wanting everyone to have political power. I'm not really sure she knew what sort of effect of what you're saying would have. But later on in the 18th century, it goes on. It actually takes instead of it being political, it goes very unpolitical because she leads to the Quakers and the Christadelphian society as well, doesn't she? Philadelphian, Christadelphian, I mixed the terms up a bit. Christadelphian, she leads to them, doesn't she?
What I've come to understand is that these groups, when they get involved with something that's a little bit bigger than just simply the group themselves, once it turns into a movement, you have people joining into the movement, and just by sheer orchestration of evolving and growing the movement, sometimes it's key to leverage individuals who are in places of power. I'll just say it like that. So it's not like she intended to grow into a political movement. In fact, I wouldn't say that she was even a political movement, but the things that she did and said through her doctrines played a role in context in some political events. Many of these groups will go back to anti-Catholic agendas. So you can find that that's something that's woven all throughout. And I'm not saying it's good or bad, but what I'm saying is in that era, the Catholicism was linked to politics because of Rome. And so there was a political undertone. I'll just say it like that. I think with Jane Lead, there was more, if I remember correct, what was it, the Glorious Revolution or something like this. She had some things that were publicly involved with those contexts. But fast forward to the NAR today. It's the same kind of thing. You may have people who do have a political agenda, who are in positions of leadership, and they want the others to join in because it helps them with whatever's their political lobbying agendas. That's why whenever people start talking about any of the modern political issues in the United States, homosexuality, for example, if you mention that phrase, people it's so overloaded what they've been trained to believe with it. Whether you agree or disagree, you have a political siding with this because it's part of that political agenda. However, there are people who are in the same movement who have no political agenda, who are completely blindsided that there even exists a political agenda, and they would argue, no, I'm against politics. I don't want to be part of that political system, and yet they're part of that political system. So in the lineup of, you've seen the people behind the King President, which we won't mention his name, in that lineup, you'll probably see people who are in our NAR, people who do have a political agenda. You might find some casual person who by happenstance got into the same position, who's a true believer of God, who has, he's there because he thinks that the movement is supporting something that furthers Christianity, not that it's furthering a political agenda. So you've got this weird mixture of people, and that's how a movement works. If a movement doesn't grow, it will never attract people who are in political spaces. As it grows, if it does attract somebody, well, think of the number of people that we can grow further if we appeal to that political space. So it's like the snowball going downhill. You really don't know what it's going to pick up, and you don't know if it's a good or bad thing that it's going to pick up, but sometimes it may pick up something that's bad that makes it strategic for the group to move forward. And so they'll pick it up, they'll adopt it, they'll move forward in that direction. And some of the directions may or may not be good, which is really the problem with all of this.
You mentioned the Glorious Revolution, which I think maybe about two other people listening would have heard of before. And this is one of my speciality knowledges here, which is to do that there's a state in the US called Maryland, which was named after Mary, who ascended to the throne in Great Britain and to a lesser extent Ireland in 16 something. The Glorious Revolution in 1690 was when her husband William, who came over from the Netherlands, keep up, because he was Protestant. At that time, the previous king, Charles II, whose father, Charles I, he'd been beheaded because he was a very good king. Charles II was becoming Roman Catholic, and he was like, yeah, thumbs up to the Pope. And the people of England thought, no, we're not going for that. So they invited Mary to take the throne, for the simplified history there. But that was what was going on. A Protestant king had been invited over to reign with Mary, who was a king and queen. He'd been invited over, and he defeated the he defeated the Roman Catholic forces in Ireland. That's where they had the battle in 1690. And that was a big showdown, you know, the forces of Protestantism versus Catholicism. And the Protestants won. And that event is commemorated every 12th of July in Northern Ireland, where they burn Irish flags and effigies of the Pope in Rome. And that's, I didn't even think of that until now, that Jane Lead, or at least people in that movement, wanting to very easily say it's all about defeating the Pope, defeating Roman Catholicism. Whereas in mainland Europe, France was very nearly the biggest Protestant country in Europe, but through an error of geography, all of the Protestants were in the southwest of France, and they just kind of got squeezed out very easily by Spain and France. And that leads us to a very difficult thing to answer for people of that time. I mean, people then would have thought God is supporting the Protestant cause. Well, not in France. It seems to have more to do with geographic convenience than actual God's manifested plan for the Protestant cause in mainland Europe. But I can certainly see now that Jane Lead would have, well, her writings and the people who want a political struggle would have been very anti-Catholic at that time. That was what was going on in Great Britain and Ireland. Is other Papists going to win? Is Great Britain and Ireland going to be oriented back towards Rome, or will the Protestants win a military victory in those two islands? And it just had to do with geography. Catholic forces didn't have much of a navy. It seems a bit demeaning to God's plan for the Protestant cause. But sometimes things go well, sometimes they don't. The Netherlands were very Protestant, and they got again and again by Spain. That was what was going on politically at the time. And the person who I mentioned earlier, Henry Dodwell, who didn't think much of Jane Lead, interestingly there, he was kicked out of the church because he didn't take the oath of allegiance to William and Mary. So he was not interested in political power. He would rather oppose the king and queen than get political power. So it's just an interesting quirk there. The person who I read who opposed her was not interested in political power in that sense. That's about as much as I've got to say politically there. But one caveat, I am involved locally in politics in Norway. The things we talk about are... don't turn left signs on the main thoroughfare in town to reduce traffic flow. Getting involved in politics. Politics comes from the Greek word polis, which means city. And Jeremiah called to everyone to seek the welfare of the city in which you live. And you're not going to sit in council meetings and say, well, I'm against homosexuality. They say, great, or not great, irrelevant. We're talking about roundabouts. We're talking about zoning laws. We're talking about which schools need to be shut. If you want to get involved in politics as a Christian and to genuinely help at a local level, you need to focus on traffic, schools, hospitals, where are we going to build the next road? That's all it means. Whereas Jane Lead putting up the manifested politicians one might say. Jane Lead, that's not what she meant. She meant something very extremely high and convoluted. But it's made me realise within the Christian life, when you aim high and shoot high, you're often going to miss and trying to aim to be a manifested son of God. But when you go for a very low resolution attempt at being a Christian, you end up hitting home. Something I said when I was on previously, people seem to appreciate. So I always kind of round things off with a bit of a Lord of the Rings reference. And people would say, why can't he mention the Bible? You know, it's so passe with the Bible. You know, it's talking about what things people understand these days. But I think it's because you said that there can be a lot of loaded language in the Bible. And if I talk about the Holy Spirit or even Pentecost, everyone's got their own association. No one's going to twist the words of Samwise Gamgee. You know, that's a fresh way of explaining it. So I don't think there's anyone unfamiliar with Lord of the Rings. But when Sam puts on the ring, God's put on the ring to escape being killed by the orcs. Sam has a vision of him with a flaming sword, banners coming all around him, rallying to his cause to defeat Sauron because he's got the ring. He thinks, actually, I don't want to establish a kingdom where everyone's my slaves trying to make the world greener. I want my own small garden at which I can tend with my own hands, which is a It's a very powerful statement Sam put on the ring, but he rejected the political power associated with it. He wanted a much smaller scale vision of prosperity and thriving. And I am still scanning diligently that Pentecostal charismatic NAR leader who says, this is the year of mediocrity. This is the year of minimum wage jobs. You are going to be the manifested job seeker. You are going to mow the lawn outside and plant a few trees and do a bit of allotmenting and grow your own. And then you won't have enough money at the end of the month and you're going to have to buy some cornflakes. You know, just very kind of mundane ways of living as a Christian. And that is all part of God's plan, to live very simply. So from Jane Lead's Manifested Sons of God and the Forerunners from IHOP KC and the Latter Rain, or I would just love to introduce terms to the Christian life of claiming the year of it was all right, you know, describing yourself as I am a steadily bumbling along Christian. And not the false sense of humility that says everyone sins a little bit, don't they? But actually just saying my vision of what I would like to achieve is, even for myself, it would be to get about 7 hours sleep a night and maybe down to 2 cups of tea or coffee a day, and eat a bit less sugar. I mean, I know you've got a great testimony there, a sort of low-scale testimony of somebody who escaped from being pre-diabetic. And, you know, these are small victories that everyone should be like, yeah, that's pretty good, you know. Go for that. That's going to affect a lot more people, your testimony of escaping being pre-diabetic, rather than saying, I grew a foot back or something, or spewed out chicken bits and there's cancer coming out of my mouth. All of that's a lie. Whereas if you went to a healing ceremony and say, who here's diabetic? Everyone's going to put up their hands. These are the sort of things that need to be healed. That's where we need the manifested sons of God actually working. And for the final Lord of the Rings reference, Aragorn, when he comes into Minas Tirith, heals a lot of people. And because it was a prophecy that the hands of the king are the hands of the healer. I don't think it's Tolkien trying to insert any biblical references. It's just about saying to rule, it's to help and to heal. And that's what Tolkien is saying he wants his king to do, to be a doctor, to walk around and help people. Yeah. Aragorn could have come into Minas Tirith and say, well, everyone needs to give me all of their money and wives, and I'm going to create a new city over there. Zion, Illinois. There's a lot of weird stuff going on there with Purim, from what I remember. Wacko cult leaders always want to establish a new city somewhere. Whereas people want to, or be colonists and go to the New World. but the worst kind of cults, the most pedestrian churches, say to you, don't get a new job, stay what you're doing. Stay living where you are. You don't need to change all that much more, because you can't really become that much better anyway. Which is a radical idea for the Christian life. You can change, you can repent, but I don't think you're going to... I don't pray for people to become richer or get a bigger house or anything. But the utopia which I would hope for is, as Samuel Scamdy said, being a gardener, tending your own land, or running your own IT business, and getting something that's achievable, rather than... very confusing Latin terms. And I know some people you've been interviewing have talked about the issues of white colonialism going in as a Christian, and to reiterate my points around language there, we would frown at Latin terms, but we have to bear in mind that the majority of people aren't English speakers in the world, and English-speaking Christianity, through the power of the Anglican Church in England and then the US later on, means that what we think of high convoluted Latin, manifested, all these funny terms, predestination, most people, normal English is the Latin, if you get one there, so that they would use very poorly translated terms into Norwegian or Swahili or Chinese, and then think that they're saying something spiritual, whereas you and I would just say, well, that doesn't really make any sense, sorry. So that's my final hip shot on Jane Lead and her Latin usage.
So my final hit shop will actually go back to the pre-diabetic thing. I was pre-diabetic. I did fasting. I lost 45 pounds, 45 days, and I warded it off for a period of time. I'm actually now fully diabetic, so it didn't last. But that's the point. When you're in one of these movements and something like that happens, you're devastated because the devil got you. And now I'm just like, you take one day at a time as a Christian. And kind of like you said, I just want to be the guy who eats cornflakes. I don't want to be the one who had this great miracle that didn't stick with me. You know what I mean? And that's the kind of life that we had to live. I knew people that were diabetic when we were in the movement. And I remember them talking about those people who weren't in our group that had our secret, and they didn't have the same access to healing. And I'm looking around, scratching my head, thinking, he's diabetic, he's got lupus, she's got lupus. I'm going down all of these lines of people. They're all sick and afflicted, man, but they think they have something they don't have. And I no longer think this, and I have some things wrong. I have some things that are actually getting better. So for me, I take one day at a time. I don't have to live with a secret mystery. And This nonsense about this mystery cult that exists in today's world, I say you're happier without it. That's my final speech. So thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks.
If you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.